So this panel's geared towards designers, organizers, educators, and it's a venue to question how we can make CTFs more effective at their goals and how we can communicate if and how CTFs are successful at those goals. I'm Mark Gondry. I'm faculty at the Naval Postgraduate School, and it's my pleasure to introduce our panelists. I'm going to introduce them at an order that I picked out of a hat at random. And they can wave as I say their names. Portia Pusey earned her doctorate in education at Towson, specializing in instructional technologies. She is the project manager and education chair for the National Cyber League. She's part of the research team at the National Cyber Watch Center, leading a study of coaches and players involved with the National Collegiate Cyber Defense Competition. She also has an evaluation role in the Cyber Competition Federation, an umbrella organization for cyber competitions. Peter Chapman, can you wave? Oh, you can, I guess, clap, I don't know. But you can reserve it to the end and we'll clap for everybody.
Yeah,
Peter Chapman is a graduate student at Carnegie Mellon. He was first technical lead for PICO CTF, which we heard about this morning, an online competition started in 2013 for high school students. He recently worked on an attack defense style CTF for the US Service Academies called IOCTF. Andy Davis is a member of the Cyber Systems Assessment Group at MIT Lincoln Labs. He's helped organize the MIT Lincoln Labs CTF competition for the last 2 years, as well as several mini CTF events at universities in the Northeast. Chris Eagle is faculty at the Naval Postgraduate School. He led teams winning DEF CON's Capture the Flag in 2004 and 2008, and then he organized DEF CON CTF from 2009 to 2012 for 4 years. He's currently designing and organizing DARPA's Cyber Grand Challenge competition. Giovanni Vigna is a professor at UC Santa Barbara and the director of its Center for Cybersecurity. Since 2003, he's organized the annual International Capture the Flag competition. ICTF is today the largest regularly reoccurring CTF in existence, and play is open to teams from 2 and 4 year universities. Thank you all for being on the panel. So my first question for all of you is, how poorly named is this panel? We have a range of activities that are being represented here, and we're calling them all Capture the Flag. Is it useful to start distinguishing between different types of competition styles?
Are there absolutely?
Yeah. Thanks. Please elaborate.
I think that panels are not fun if they're not controversial. So, yeah, absolutely. I think that it's time that we talk about security competition, security educational competition, and I really like who put the matrix with the different. Students, you did? It was you. Okay, I love that matrix. It's a great way of showing how you can have different designs and different audiences. Especially, I think it's important to distinguish different types of scoring mechanisms. For example, I know there are certain competition that have. A human being with a paper and a piece of paper going around teams and scoring them according to what they do, and I think that's a different type of competition than something that has to be scored automatically. They require infrastructure and can be easily replicated, for example. So I think that we should come out of this workshop with a suggestion on how to name stuff and say, hey, let's call CTF the sort of attack defense. Let's call hacking Jeopardy or challenge-based competition, the one that are challenge-based, and other. And it would be great to hear, more suggestion or, simulation-based games that we have seen at least a couple of them. So that's definitely a start, because I think they're really different type of efforts and different types of experiences that are involved in those competitions.
I agree in a lot of ways. CTF is not a great name. And this is something that the community itself has kind of addressed a little bit. There are fairly standard kind of groups of, if someone goes on the IRC and is like, I know this great CTF, one of the first questions is, what kind is it? And they'll often describe it as the attack defense, which is multiple teams attacking each other. Jeopardy style, which is also not a great name, but refers to the challenge-based competitions. And then there's also war games. Traditionally, these Jeopardy-style CTFs are taken offline shortly after the competition ends. And so war game is often used to describe something that is maintained for students to come in at any time and go through challenges and educate themselves. And one example of that would be like Smash the Stack. And so those are kind of, within the community, those are fairly standard groupings. But as we've seen today, and as we're starting to see more and more of, there's a lot of diversity. And this is, I think, a very important question of categorizations help people know what they're going to expect when they decide to participate. And so trying to figure out where these groupings are and recognizing these outlying hidden gems is going to be something very important going forward.
So today I think you've gotten to know me as the queen of shameless plugs, so here comes another one. FYI, I work for educational organizations that have nothing that we do is a commercial product, and most of our work is at the behest of thanks to the National Science Foundation. So everything that we have is free, and I'm not trying to make any money. I just want to let you know it's out there. So the Cybersecurity Competition Federation has been struggling with this issue too. Exactly how do you explain the rules so we can engage younger people in this activity? So for someone who doesn't know anything about this, it's a real challenge. We've also, I would add to your list, inherit and defend. I would add inherit and defend. That's when you inherit a network and someone tries to attack you as you try to keep it live. That's like a CCDC. Forensics competitions to that, and some people would add cryptography. I'm just saying that. So where this list is coming from is from the Cybersecurity Competition Federation. If you go to our website, we've got some very smart people together a year ago, thanks to the National Science Foundation, and they brainstormed a list of these categories. And I would encourage you to go look there. And this is the last time I will plug their website, so that you can look at and go to the wiki and see what the working groups have produced. The national. So, if you just Google Cybersecurity Competition Federation,
nationalcfs.org.
Thank you, nationalcfs.org.
I guess I will agree that we're sort of diluting our terms, because I know we've had problems with, I guess, people coming in expecting sort of like a hackathon type thing, because some people right now are like these programming, like weekend long programming competitions where everyone does a project. Some of them are advertising themselves as CTFs. Build it, break it, fix it is sort of a hybrid of a hackathon and a CTF, and they advertise as CTF. But I mean, we stole the name from another game, so we can't really argue. We diluted one term because we've had people, you know, say CTF and like show up in like shorts and a t-shirt and expect to be running around the field. So it's not it's partially our fault. So we started the dilution of terms. So I don't know. Someone wants to come up with some sort of scheme, which it seems like has been done, if that would be beneficial or not. And maybe CTF is just a catch-all term for all of these competitions, and then you have to have a type. But I agree that probably some classification needs to be done.
So as a longtime CTF player / organizer, I think among the established CTF players, there's a pretty well understood terminology. When we talk about a full spectrum attack defend, we know what we mean. Puzzle style / Jeopardy style, I think we all know what we mean, or ladder and progressive like Smash the Stack. What I think is lacking is any kind of categorization of what are the goals of the organizers. So if I'm putting on a DEF CON CTF, I'm targeting a very specific audience. I'm looking for the best of the best. I'm looking to crown some kind of champion. But there are other CTFs that are put on for purely educational purposes. Where the value may be in post-exercise debriefing and walkthroughs and things like that, which you don't necessarily get out of a competitive, full-on, like, professional league, whatever you want to call it. So I think what we need to do better, in addition to perhaps categorizing these things, is really try to advertise what are your goals here, who's your target audience, am I targeting high school kids, am I starting undergrad, or am I targeting security professionals? And start to advertise what the expected takeaways. Sometimes there are none. sometimes your intent is to provide a very robust set of data that comes out of the exercise.
I strongly agree with that. I think it's really important. And I think that my perception, and it's not based on actual data, it's more of a gut feeling, is that there are many many students that would be excited to participate in this activity because of this lack of description of the goals or the intended function of this type of competition. They're completely scared. They you know, I'm going to be thrown in this arena with these people who are going to hack my laptop and leave me, you know, crying in front of my, you know, hacked Facebook page or something like that. And instead creating some kind of expectation, especially in terms of the roughness of the game, is important. You know, you go to DEF CON and you're like, well, the gloves are off. You know, here the, you know, the network cable, it's your problem. And if you ask for help, you know, you're like, well, you know, you're supposed to be one of the best hackers in the world. What are you talking about? And instead, there are other games that need to be inclusive and very supportive. So I think that's important. I think we have done so far, and I'm talking about myself, a very poor job. We limited, for example, our competition to universities. That's true. We got some serious, you know, bad press because of that, because we were not inclusive of the industry. But I think we're going to keep it like that. But I think it's important to state the goals better, and we haven't done enough.
I don't think I had realized that. What's the expectation of the audiences? Is there some belief that all your games should be inclusive of as many people as possible? I was going to ask if one of the natural...
No, you're right. I mean, DEF CON is not inclusive. I mean, DEF CON is you qualify, you show up, or you win another competition and you qualify. And, you know, there is no real no mercy. And that's the beauty of it, you know, that there is really, hey, show up, do your best, you know, don't cry if you end up last, okay, and go ahead. Well, in our competition, for example, if somebody has a problem with network, we help debugging their network setup. We want to include them because we feel that, I feel that our competition really wants to be part of an education process, and it was born like that.
Like, Peter, do you get industry sort of asking why they can't play in the high school game, or...?
Yeah, we got a little bit, and we got a bunch of emails from, to simplify the distribution of prizes, we had over $20,000 in prizes that we limited prizes to high school students, high school, middle school students, I guess, in the United States. And so we got a lot of flack for not being able to incorporate foreign teams. And that was simply done out of practicality, that it's a lot easier for us to determine if a team from Missouri is actually competing legitimately than a team from somewhere in Europe. And so... well, not everyone speaks English, so that's a personal barrier of entry there. We've released the materials, and people have basically rehosted it to incorporate more teams. There was more or less a rehosted version done in Korea, and we also hosted it ourselves for a large internet corporation. If your goal is to make a competitive event such as DEF CON, there isn't really a need to be inclusive, but I get the feeling from talking to members of PPP and other CTF teams that they would like the community to grow larger. And they'd like it to grow larger because they like this trend of the CTFs going towards a very competitive, almost cyber gaming direction. And we've seen a little bit, members of PPP have started this weekly session on Twitch where they live stream them solving CTF problems. And so they like this idea that CTFs are almost a sport. And in a lot of the ways that there's been recent press, a $10 million competition for online gaming. And so they're kind of caught up on this idea, and it sounds really cool. And it in a lot of ways legitimizes even more so the awesomeness that is what happens at DEF CON and the absolute skill being demonstrated there. So that's just one reason why perhaps being inclusive even for those competitions would benefit them.
So getting back to inclusivity, exclusivity, I think there are aspects of DEF CON CTF that are completely open to everybody. The qualifiers are open. In fact, you have many opportunities to qualify, and anybody can give it a shot. The problem is that it's not an entry-level type of thing, right? So if you're looking to get involved, it's trial by fire when you drop in on a DEF CON qualifier, because you know that stuff, again, is meant to be a filter and intentionally geared towards finding the cream of the crop. And as organizers, we watched over many years, well, as players before that and as organizers, you would watch teams start out and finish well down in the pack. We watched the number of people participating grow and grow and grow, and yet you know, teams clearly put an effort in, and you'd watch them climb until almost the greatest achievement of their life to date was when they finally qualified for DEF CON after trying for perhaps 6 years. It's not the easiest way to get better at what you're doing. It's definitely not geared to be educational, but the number of CTS that have grown and modeled in whether it's DEF CON or the DEF CON qualifier puzzle styles is huge. You can play CTF almost every weekend and do challenges that range in skill from beginners up to unsolvable stuff. Well, Tom Cruise kind of stuff, but you know.
So I'm bursting with feedback. So the first thing is that I would like to say is that every competition can't be everything to everyone. And there's a very important reason for that, is as you're learning, we need to give people a legal and safe place to practice. We can't set them in the wild, wild west or expect, I know a lot of the high schoolers that I have, they want to build their reputation and they're getting into trouble. So we have to be careful about that. Number two, if we're not talking about the career changers, you're talking about children, they're high school kids or even middle school kids, that I don't think it's appropriate for them to be playing in the same kind of environments with adults when there can be interactions, and if you want to bring it into a school situation, we need to protect our young. The other thing is that I think it's a good idea to build one of the things that the CCF is doing is building a pathway so that you can self-identify your point of entry based on what you're interested in. Perhaps you're someone who really likes the excitement of being attacked. Maybe you're someone else who's more interested in the diagnostic piece and wants to learn that. So I think it's really that from that perspective. Finally, the last piece I wanted to address was that if we can classify and we can identify what competitions are appropriate for an individual, I think it's also important to develop an assessment so that people can see, once you start getting some skill, then you can start seeing where you fit on that pathway based on what you actually can do, so that you're competing and you're not being disengaged, because when we're talking about filling a national need, we can't afford to be disengaging people at the same time.
All right, so, well, I guess, in terms of inclusivity and whatever, we probably have the least inclusive CTF of anyone here, because realistically for ours, you have to be an undergraduate or graduate student at a university, you have to make it to MIT, and we have no travel stipend, we have no funds to do travel stipend, and you have to have signed up ahead of time and have some number of people signed up. So we have like 100 teams with one person on it, and we say you either need to group together to form cohesive teams or drop out, and about 80% of them do. So we have that, but we have physical limitations of space and things like that we have to make cuts for. We don't give preference to, you know, any university or anything like that. If a university from another country did want to come and play, then they can show up, then they can. But one thing we actually have found that I was curious about in terms of inclusivity and exclusivity is specifically tools. So the big one is IDA Pro. So if you don't have IDA Pro and you're trying to do a binary exploitation challenge, it's very difficult. The problem is some teams have copies of IDA Pro and are very proficient with it. There's some other types of challenges where tools exist. That's the one that, I guess, since I'm a reverse engineer, that's the one that comes to mind first. But we noticed that teams who have, like, the only teams that really ever solve these binary challenges are teams that have IDA Pro. Now, I don't know if that's they're good at doing binary analysis and thus have a copy of IDA Pro and could have done it without it anyway, or that is an enabler. But I was curious if, from an educational perspective, you know, is IDA Pro like the TI calculator of exploitation, where you got to have this, you have to have a, you know, TI 83 or whatever to pass $100 calculator to pass AP calculus? Do you have to have a $1,000 license?
I think the answer is yes.
Okay, so you have to have
X-rays, the decompiler.
Yeah, no, that's the other thing, right? So like, you buy IDA Pro for like $500, and then if you pen like $2,000, you can get like an even better option, and that's just kind of a, and a CTF every minute counts, and that's a huge, huge differentiator. So I was just curious if anyone is.
I will point out that there is a free demo version of IDA that does x86, 32-bit x86 and ARM disassembly. It's fairly full-featured. No, 6.6, demo version.
Oh, really? Oh,
yeah, yeah, latest, greatest. They always have a demo version out.
Doesn't it time out after an hour?
It does not time out.
Okay.
It gives you a, thanks for using IDA, click OK, continue.
Okay.
I'm really curious about the use of CTFs in the classroom. Is there an aspect of timing where it's, you mentioned how you could probably play a CTF every weekend, but is there an ideal timeline of when CTFs would crop up so you can prepare and design classes around them, or?
Actually, I'm gonna take this because, actually the ICTF started in 2001 as an in-class sort of like attacker versus defenders, and the defenders complained that it wasn't fun enough. And then in 2002, we made in-class attack and defend. And in 2003, we started opening to other university. But it has always been sort of the final of a class that I would teach during fall. That's why we always do it in December, because it's the final for the class. And I think that having a structure, I was talking to other instructor, having something synchronized where we can do fall quarter. We all teach a class on vulnerability analysis and attack and defense. And when we all go together and do an inter-university capture the flag, that would be fantastic. Because it's not just, it's also, I like the idea that you take somebody from knowing nothing about security to be in a competition. And the teams that I usually bring two teams from UCSB to the competition that I organized, they don't know anything about what's going on, but, you know, and they're always destroyed because it's the first time they play, and so they get, you know, annihilated in the first 5 minutes by everybody. But still, for them, it's going from knowing absolutely zero to, you know, knowing how to do a relatively simple buffer overflow format string vulnerability. And for them, it's a lot. And I think it's that is really where the learning happens.
And for me, as a faculty member, I've always found it easier to have an extracurricular group where we're almost meeting year-round. And students come and students go, but the timing of these things all over the world is you know, unpredictable and certainly not in harmony with your academic calendar. So to continue for us to do it essentially year-round, and again, the students can come or not, has been the best way for them to stay involved in things that are going on. But otherwise, it's a dedicated course with an end-of-quarter exercise.
Controversial.
Hey, so my name is Mark Filethazi from Crisis Lab, aka Spam and Hacks. So for us, it was the same story. It started out with the ICTF, by the way, and we competed. We failed miserably. Then the next time, we didn't fail that much, and this time the guys really got enthusiastic. So they are actually practicing once a week. So they come together, and we call it a Crisis Core Group, because it's a core team. They're just coming together all the time. And now they are really looking for, oh, what's the next CTF I can do? And to be honest, we did a little motivation at the beginning, and now they are self-motivating, and it's a self-selection group too, which means that it's invitation only, so people cannot join just like that. It's a specific structure we built up. You have to earn the honor to join the group, by doing projects at our courses, or by competing with on other exercises. So it's an effort, and it's self-organizing in a sense that it's growing in momentum. So that's one thing. The other thing, that there was a discussion before about inclusivity, and Yeah, language is a barrier. When Peter had the presentation before, I chatted the guys immediately back there if Pico CTF could be applied to Hungary. They said, like, well, language is a big barrier. So if you really want to reach out, then you have to find a way to somehow do the language barrier. And Europe and Asia, and there's big markets and big interest from there. But those guys just can't speak English yet. So you have to find a way to reach them, maybe through technology, maybe through like local trainers, someone who can translate to them, local study groups or something. But there has to be a way. So thanks for the efforts, and our group is really enthusiastic. So I hope to see Spamant Hex later.
Awesome. That's no controversy at all. You know that.
I think I tend to agree with the way you guys have organized and the way I guess they've organized an MPS with. When I was at Georgia Tech, we started a special group to do it. There were classes that were sort of CTF based and stuff like that, but it's not really a skill set that's conducive to classroom learning, I guess. Like, there's no textbook on how to win a CTF. I guess there's certain skills, certain topics you can hit on. I will say for our CTF, we did have one professor in a local university make it basically the final. And that's like extremely cruel. If you're our professor and force your students to come to a 48-hour nonstop final where they're going to be beat on continuously by people who are far more skilled, or not necessarily far more skilled than them, but people who haven't just taken a single class in this, that's probably the wrong way to go. Yeah, I
disagree with that.
You disagree? Well, I don't know how much they got out of it. They seemed to actually enjoy it to some extent. They were not, you know, their grade did not reflect their position in the CTF. So I guess that would be my only concern, is if you have like an international CTF and your grade is dependent on how well you do, there may be some, I guess, problems there. But
So let me just share the experience of the National Cyber League. It's and this is gets to the exclusivity question, because the bottom line is every competition can't be everything to everyone. So if I could be controversial, it should be exclusive, these things. And so what the National Cyber League has done is it has aligned their competitions with the Security Plus exam and the Certified Ethical Hacking exam. And the progression of the competition, it's this year we're having two individual competitions for individuals and a competition for teams. And these competitions, the early competitions, are formative, and we provide feedback and let them know where they stand relative to their bracket and relative to nationally, and it lets them know where they can improve. So when you're talking about competitions and education, I would separate the two ideas, that competitions are educational, because they are. I always say CCDC, the kids cry, but they love it, and they say it's the best competition they've ever participated in. I mean, the best learning experience. They learned more in 2 days than they learned in their entire college career. Competitions can be educational. Using competitions in education requires a different level and a different support mechanism around the activities.
Cynthia, do you have a question?
I have a question, yeah. At NPS, we have the two cyber wargaming classes, and I was wondering, Chris, if you could speak to them as in comparison with this other stuff, because it is we are talking about education, and we have those two classes, and then I'll let you comment on Porsche's thing if you want.
The classes to which Cynthia is referring is we have a Blue Force, Red Force exercise that we put on in every other quarter, where students that are earlier in their tenure there act as a Blue Force. They build and defend network, or they do defense-oriented activities. And two quarters later, they get to come back as the Red Force and do offensive-oriented activities. So they've seen it from both sides of the fence. They come from, they're not a deep technical computer science background necessarily, so it's difficult to take them to full spectrum CTF, but they get to see both sides of the fence, and we do it that way, again, gearing up towards sort of a graduate level exercise towards the end. So again, in line with Giovanni's manner of teaching her.
I have a controversial question.
I got a microphone.
Over at NYU, we're trying to partner up with a bunch of groups who are trying to bring women and minorities into tech and into security. And they don't like the way we run CTF. They think, even though it's open to everyone, and they think it's still too exclusive, they think we get all kinds of ideas. Some of the ones that are coming to mind is they want us to remove scores. So it's a competition with challenges and nobody wins. They want us to make it more educational focused, but not the way we do it. They want us to teach people how to solve the challenges during the competition. So they play, and then they learn how to do it, and everyone wins. What do you guys think of that kind of thing?
Could you clarify who they
is? It's a horrible idea.
Not a fan.
They?
I could probably look it up for you. We talk with all
administration?
External third-party, like, nonprofits that we're trying to work with, yeah.
Can I represent all of womankind in this one? So this is... I want to be controversial. And so what they're proposing at this point is they're saying, let's take a Lego and let's make it pink, and girls are going to use it. And so what I suggest is, I'm a gamer. And you don't see a lot of women gamers. And I'm not going to convince all of them, as much of a leader as I am, and as influential and as much as I love it, I'm not going to be able to convince my friends to come and play with me online. It's not going to happen. So the trick is, and I believe when it comes to competitions, is finding tasks, because it's not that women aren't competitive, we're highly competitive. It's finding tasks that we want to do and then turn it into a competition.
I will say that an interesting sort of blowback towards the end of DEF CON CTF has been the atmosphere in which the live event takes place has traditionally been very hostile to both women and children. And so there's an interesting conversation taking place out there online in the wake of DEF CON CTF, and it will be interesting to see what changes are made by the current organizers. So, rightly or wrongly, that is the tradition. It is DEF CON CTF. It certainly does need to be toned down and become more welcoming.
Did they hand out creeper cards this year?
Creeper cards? I don't know if they were being handed out or not.
What are creeper cards?
You're a creep.
I never got
Here's
one.
Your card.
Oh, really? No, I think that the idea of making DEF CON more less offensive is a big mistake, because part of the allure of DEF CON is just it's a underground hacking convention is supposed to be offensive. I think it should be more offensive to everybody. I'm, for example, I love that. No. That's a different story. No. That's terrible. But for example, I like that now DEF CON has a queer con component, so the LGBTQ community can be part of it and can have, you know, the queer con badge and wear it with pride. And I think that We need to, you know, tease more the nerds that, you know, are the major part of the conference. I think that I agree. Most of the content that is shown is, you know, usually offensive and, you know, demeaning mostly to women. And I might say there is more respect for the gay community than there is for the for women at DEF CON, and that's a big problem that I would like to see solved, but in a creative and disruptive way, not going into, for this particular venue, down the path of PC correctness, because I think it would neuter some of the interesting stuff that happens in that sort of like crazy environment. But these things aside, I think that I agree. My beloved daughter loves pink Lego, but loves all Lego other than pink. But she loves the pink Legos the most. But making something non-competitive is not a good solution. I think that we will be able to include more women in CTF competitions when we start including more women in computer science, period. Once they will be all in computer science, they will see the niche of, you know, computer security competition as one more thing that can make theirs. But first, you know, I think that, I mean, as a professor, I mean, the struggle that we have is to convince in the first place that doing a computer science career is cool, and you know, to create an environment where women are welcome. It's not, I don't think it's a CTF problem, it's a computer science problem.
CMU has 50% women. How many percent, what's the percentage of the PVP?
That's a good, CMU.
I probably couldn't give you a percentage, but I could give you a number, and it's very low. It's a huge problem, and there are ways to try to address it. PPP in particular, this isn't their priority. Their priority is to win competitions, but especially in organizing Pico CTF, we wanted to try to remove as many barriers to entry as possible. There's a difference between building a competition that's like been toned down to make everyone happy and then removing very strong barriers to entry. So one example, there's a handful of examples we did in building Pico CTF. One was that when you're hacking the robot in the during the story of the game, you aren't doing anything. You're not like breaking into a place and then destroying the facility. You're solving these challenges in order to repair the robot, and that way it's less adversarial, and that responds well to a wider range of people than just people that are trying to destroy things. Additionally, in terms of removing barriers to entry, there are ways to build challenges such that they don't hamper the competition, yet are more accommodating to people that aren't experienced. So one example of this is, instead of going all the way where every challenge has solutions to it, you take three or four of the beginning challenges, and we did this more or less to a degree with a handful of challenges in Pico CTF. There is a tutorial that more or less walks you through how to do these challenges. And in no way, shape, or form did this dictate who won the competition. These were very small challenges, but to people that had no experience in competitions, these were some of their favorite sections. Just raved about them in terms of how they were able to actually participate because they got the support they needed to find something they really found interesting. And so in solving these challenges, we just walked them through how to do it, and they were able to score a few hundred points, but they weren't the top 50, and they didn't care because they were actually able to do something. They didn't walk away with, this is too hard for me. And they left with a very positive experience, and then next year they can come through and try to do a little bit better. And this is one of the ways you can try to increase the diversity of your audience, is removing these barriers to entry, allowing them to enter and participate, and then slowly become part members of the community, and then from there.
So with RCTF, I will say we have, you know, 15-ish teams there, and we have two entirely female teams. And they, I guess, keep showing up, so I guess they're having some benefit out of it. And all we did is just go to a local all-women's university and ask, like, do you want to play? And they said, sure, and showed up. So I don't know if it's actually we need to change anything or do anything to attract more women. One comment I would make, we've heard a lot, I don't follow it at all, so I don't really play that many online games, but there's these large online gaming competitions. I would be curious to see what the ratio of women in those is. If we want, that's probably the closest analogy, right, to what we're trying to do with a cyber online competition. I know there are video games that are supposed to appeal to women. As a commercial enterprise, it would be stupid if there weren't. So I was just curious, in these competitions, if anyone knows, what's the ratio, gender ratio there?
Do you all agree that sort of digital games inclusivity of women should be sort of the baseline for ours, for CTFs? Do you all sort of agree that digital games sets a sort of baseline for the types of audience that we could reach out to or be inclusive to? That you're like, oh, well, if we can't do better than X percent.
I don't think we should set our aspirations to a group or a community that isn't already diverse. I think that's kind of trying to throw away the problem.
We also can't expect to have substantially higher percentage of women participating in CTF than are present in computer science as a whole. So I think the right answer is we need to address that problem starting at a very young age and get the numbers in computer science across the board up, and then we would expect to see female participation in every aspect of computer science, not just CTF.
So one of the things that Harvey Mudd does is their intro computer science courses, instead of starting from computer science, start from some sort of goal. And I'm wondering if we could use educational-focused CTFs as one of those goals, where we construct them so that there are these challenges as a way to pull people in and say, hey, you can learn to do these things. These things are interesting and neat. And along the way, you have to learn all these computer science concepts in order to succeed. And I'm in particular curious about your perspective on that versus the removing the scoring, removing things. But I'd be happy to hear from anyone in the panel. I don't mean to put you on the spot there.
So you go ahead. I was just going to say, so I guess moving on to the further dilution of the term CTF, if you have a class where you just have a whole bunch of challenges that you get walked through and, you know, you kind of approach and are walked through, is that really, I mean, it's definitely not a competition.
I was thinking actually the end of the class is a CTF.
Okay.
And we're gonna teach you these things because these are the skills that you're going to need to go and win this thing.
Okay. So I know there are, I know Northeastern University does something like this where the entire class is set up as a CTF. But I was just curious, and we're throwing around the term, you know, CTF a lot and trying to keep them all straight. So I agree, like project-based education is great. There's lots of universities that have implemented that. Having a competition at the end, I mean, that's effectively just a project-based test, which could work and could not. I don't know. You run into some problems. For example, in an attack defense CTF, generally on a test, you know, it's not, if I get to write your problems and you get to write my problems, and whoever writes the hardest problem can, you know, whoever can think of a harder problem the other one can't solve gets a better grade. So I don't know how much that would work, but I think it's definitely, you know, certain schools are doing it to, you know, Northeastern has pretty good CTF players, and I don't know if what the causality there was, but.
So let me go to the research to answer that question, because there seems to be a gender difference in help-seeking behaviors. So I'm not sure which one, but some people would prefer to be walked through step by step. Some people just want to be able to go learn it on their own. And the reason why I'm looking at my notes is because this is a new path of research that I was looking at, so I apologize for not knowing it by heart. Or to see if they've performed the task before, then they feel like if they could just go to somebody if they need help, or if just be able to call somebody if they get stuck. But there is a set of people who would prefer step-by-step instructions. The efficacy research would seem to indicate that if you build on a series of successes, then even among women and it can overcome societal messages to women that women don't whatever, and if it's part of cybersecurity competitions, we can convince them to whatever. And then there's the other piece that's really very, very interesting. In Israel, and this is a study with the Olympiad, it was a math or science Olympiad, and in Israel, they were having trouble with competition balance between male and female. So they specifically targeted women to provide interventions for. They made all women teams. They provided them gender targeted, you know, using the best research. What do women want? How do they best want to learn? They did all of this, and they still had problems with retention and participation, even though they were singled out for this intervention in the Olympiads. So it's that's why I think we need to revert back to, let's find something. I think that competitions have a place in education as formative and summative education, but they don't look like what these guys do. They looked completely different. And then in terms of women aren't going to participate in what they're doing. Like you said, we're already drawing from, if gaming is already disproportionate, women aren't gaming. Women aren't playing these competitions. So we need to do something different if we want to attract women.
Thanks.
Could everybody on the panel sort of comment about the role of formative and summative assessments? Because even some of the very competitive short-term games that people come into, it's unclear to me if the role is purely summative, like you will get a score, someone may recruit you at the end, or if the idea is that even these summative games are intended to be jumping off points as formative evaluations in a follow-on course or a walkthrough or an extracurricular?
I think it's a very difficult question to answer. I think that we should look at CTFs as, you know, Olympians running the 100 meters. You know, they might run the fastest at one particular instance, but it's all the training, the years of training to come before that, you know, shot that matter. That's the educational value. And the fact that you, we need to emphasize how long a person has been preparing for something, what are the skill set that he thinks or she thinks she achieved. That's going to be super difficult. I'm going to just use she. That she achieved to get there so that you can evaluate the ability, for example, to participate in the workforce in a meaningful fashion, the security workforce. I think that the competitions need to have a ranking. It's something that you cannot get out of it. But I think that the value is not in the ranking. The value is you were there, you participated actively, and you prepared for a certain amount of time. And I think one thing that we all suck in doing is evaluating the effort that took people to get to a certain point in a cyber competition. We always look at the moment where we're there, we're very good at, you know, automatic scoring of this and that and SLAs and other things that are very cool. But it would be great as educators if we could find a way to say, okay, we want to find, I don't know, I have no idea how to do it. But if, you know, maybe people that do actual education could figure it out, that we have a way to assess their progress in preparing for the event. Because we have that for athletes, but we don't have it for people that do hacking competitions.
No, I think I have follow on. The constellation of CTFs that just occur all the time and engage in them, and you'll grow as an athlete. Like, it's a very different style that. When we have bracketed competitions where you need to do well in the first one in order to get to the next one, are there feelings about the interrelationships of games like that, or should it just be a constellation of things you show up for to build a muscle?
Actually, DEF CON started promoting people from other competition into DEF CON, I think a couple of years ago?
DEF CON.
You started,
DEF CON,
I think so.
Was our first year doing that, yeah.
Yeah.
So I have a question. What do you think of doing some kind of an overall, like take all the competitions that exist within the U.S. and then do a U.S. national trophy and some way doing point scores, so like NASCAR or some things do where you get points for everyone, you have to participate in so many, and then you end up with a national team?
I actually know a little bit about this, and I know that's a planted question, because so there are two organizations that are thinking about this, and maybe they're related. One is Greg White out of who does this. Sorry, guys, I'm drawing a blank. Does the CCDC, and then Karen Evans' group she also is thinking about this National Cup, and it probably has merit, and especially for employers seeking someone who can get a track record, and when you're looking for people who are outstanding. But the problem is at the root of it is, can we find a common metric that can be certified across the competitions so that it actually is a national cup, that it cannot be gamed, it cannot be manipulated. Remember, we're dealing with, this is how I always refer to the population, these are our little hackers, and so we have trouble with people who are gaming the systems, and so we have to have a common metric that unifies whoever wants to be part of this cyber cup, and that's the challenge that they have right now.
I think, at least at the moment, DEF CON is that. DEF CON's the CTF. If you win DEF CON, that's it. that is the national, that's the International Hacker Cup in terms of skills. They have a qualifier that sets it up. There is a CTF time, is another organization that kind of collects scoreboards from all of the CTFs, and it's not the most scientific or formally weighted thing, but it is one that does that. Other than that, yeah, I mean, I think realistically the answer to your question is DEF CON. That kind of already exists, and DEF CON's it.
So one of the problems is, in order to facilitate this, you'd have to have some sort of standards body that was producing almost all the CTFs, and they had the question pool and they managed it. You know, CTF time is an interesting effort, but there's definitely no way to compare CTFA against CTFB that are organized by two completely different bodies, and CTF time just does a, you know, seat of the pants waiting. I think that that's a, I give that weight a 76. I give this one a 90 over there, and just for no particular reason, perhaps other than popularity, word of mouth, they're friends with the organizers. CTF time, I've spoken to their people, and they have lofty goals. They really want it to be sort of the international ranking body for CTF teams. But again, in my mind, CTF teams are so fungible. Right, you're on one team this week and another team next week. You play with 10 different teams across the year, but you finally qualify with another team, so you're lending your talent across the board and sort of distorting what any team rankings really mean. It's a very difficult process.
Also, I want to add that in this particular environment, computer security competition, so much is made out of reputation and coolness and bragging rights. And there is always a little bit of cloak and dagger. You know, security is cool because, you know, you're breaking stuff. You have that, you know, thrill of owning somebody else's service / machine. And I think that if the government or the federal government would come and say, here's the CTF, and this is the championship, people would laugh and just walk away.
So let me just couch what she's talking about. Because she's not saying that the government should come in and say, here is the CTF. Yes, I know. So let's also talk about the different kinds of people that we need to secure our national infrastructure. And let's talk about the kinds of things. And so, yes, right now, in your community, the reputation is important. And I have to say that this competition is really important, and these kinds of competitions are especially important because they challenge one another, and these challenges make us stronger, and as a nation, we'll be stronger as a result. Now, let's go back to the government also needs people who can work within the law, and employers want evidence of what people's skills are. And so if there were an independent body, let's think of this in terms of a sports analogy, and NASCAR Cup is the reason why she chose NASCAR Cup, and the reason why that analogy was used is that there's a common metric in NASCAR, and this, I am not a NASCAR girl, but I only know this from gaming, is that the points accumulate across the races. And so what you may not participate in all the races, but your points accumulate, and so there is an overall winner. So for a certain kind of person, not the people who are attracted to your competitions, but for a different kind of person, this is a valuable investment, I think.
So is there maybe some value in collecting statistics on individuals and giving people a venue to have this sort of social network that shows, instead of just collecting sort of an ad hoc rating of teams so that team names can accumulate cred over time, but rather look at individuals?
If you're looking for a group of people who don't want statistics collected about them, you look at the people who play in CTFs. Like that will be rejected, I think, pretty wholeheartedly just based on the personality types of people. Like you can't get people's names.
Like, oh no! I meant pseudonymous identities. Oh, just maybe pseudonymous.
Also, the one problem which you mentioned a little bit is building a system which people can't game in a game about gaming a system. Right. Like you're gonna have a very hard time.
So for us, collusion is a huge problem. How do you verify that you know somebody is who they claim they are? For me, to try to evaluate an individual's skills in this room, I would lock them in a Faraday cage and say, demonstrate your capability to me. because I have no way of knowing in this large CTF community whether a person is as good as their online persona would indicate, or whether they're being fed answers from all their buddies, right? So sharing of answers in CTFs is it's an incredibly difficult problem to attempt to prevent, identify, et cetera. And so for me, I'm not a big fan of that idea.
I'm going to give just a short perspective. I also have a company that does security work, and we hire, you know, a lot of security engineers. And whenever we see that they participated in, you know, white hatters or all sorts of different capture the flag competition, for us is always a sign, okay, this guy, you know, thought about it and put his work in, you know, participating in these competitions. Is it good? Not necessarily so, but we know that participating is like when you look at somebody's curriculum and say, hey, I played, you know, I was in the ultimate frisbee team of my school. He's probably, you know, a good frisbee guy. Maybe he was just a mascot and he actually sucks royally. But, you know, chances are that he knows a couple of throws. And the same thing applies to these things. I think this is the extent because of the anonymity, because of the group culture, and the fact that, you know, Ronins are moving from one team to another, you cannot really tell. Then, you know, it's a good sign. You hire them, you put them in a Faraday cage, and you evaluate them, and then you have your answer. I think that's a good way to do it.
We prefer moderator, not mascot. So this very jumpy group, that what statistics can we collect from them? I mean, we saw a graph earlier from Portia about people that don't show up twice. But if we're not asking them their names or if they went to a game before, like we're able to do in sort of a bracketed system, how do we know this constellation of all these dozens of independent games are attracting people back beyond their team names?
Okay, so once I spoke for all womankind, now I'm going to speak of all hacker kind. So I don't think that's the group you want to collect statistics from. I think that you know, this is you're talking about two different populations, and the kind of games that three of you on the panel participate in are a lot different than ours. So maybe you could speak, because I keep speaking on the behalf of the education and the education audience and the gaming in classrooms. Do you mind if I pass this to you? And
so I guess it's very true that we're talking about, at a high level, setting up an overall organization between competitions. But at its core, this is a community that doesn't want to be organized. And so any efforts externally, unless it's coming from a widely respected source, namely one of the members of the community, is just going to be ignored very promptly. For groups of people that don't already have a strong CTF community, per se, high school students, it may be possible to do such a thing. Now, there's a whole host of issues with tracking information of individual high school students, but there actually is possibly an opportunity there to set up some organization in the same way that similar high school level groups do. But again, if our goal, a lot of the goals, especially in creating Pico CTF, was to maintain the authenticity of the greater community. And in a lot of ways, it's kind of not, it's a little against the authenticity of the greater community to set up very strict rules for a CTF team consists of five people between these ages, and they're allowed to do these things. And if they get caught doing at some point, you then have all kinds of regulations. If they're caught doing something, if they have a misdemeanor, disqualified kind of things. And then that's just kind of the stuff that goes on with these regulations, and that's where you really start questioning the authenticity of the effort you're doing there.
Thanks. So I'll jump in with a maybe different topic. What knowledge, skills, and abilities do you think you're communicating to the audience? For those of you that have games where you hope they'll get something out of it, whether it's a very, you know, competitive game that you don't expect they'll necessarily win when they do it, but we're going to bring them to it anyway because it's a big event. Like, what do you hope they walk away from? Or how do you ensure that they walk away with a certain thing?
So I can speak for Pico CTF in that This is a question we got a lot, especially in the planning stages, is let's make a list of all the things we want to teach them. And what we eventually decided was we're not so much interested in a series of skills that we want to impart on the student, but rather a mindset and empowerment. So we want students to be in the mindset, the computer security expert mindset of you question everything. You don't trust what someone tells you, you don't trust the implementation, you actually test yourself and you explore. And that's very powerful, especially from the perspective of a computer security expert, or upcoming one. Additionally, we really wanted to empower students. It's too often that at the high school level that a student is following the tutorial, following the guide. And this was an issue for a lot of students was when presented a problem, they go, I've never learned this before, so that's the teacher's fault, and I'm not going to do this anymore. But that's the exact opposite of how you need to react when, especially, this is something true of computer science. People will tell you they don't know how to use that library. They just look at the API. They search it on the internet. Let me Google it for you. And we wanted to really instill this mentality that during this competition, there is nothing in this competition you've done before, and you're going to teach yourself all of it, and you can do it. And the first problem in the competition was a boot error code from Windows, and it's nothing but all it tells you is that it's like 0x42345. What's the file system of the hard drive? And that there's no way anyone knows what that is, but the only way to solve the problem is to search on the internet. And right from there, we established the mentality that you are going to be teaching yourself, and you have the abilities to do this on your own. And that's far and away what I wanted students leaving the competition doing. So not only that they are getting this computer security background, but they can say, oh, I want to start programming with an Arduino. And I'm not afraid to do that because I learned how to do a buffer overflow. I've taught all that stuff on my own. I can get started doing this. Anything's possible. That was no particular skill, but rather than those mindsets. And that gave us a lot of freedom in terms of choosing problems. So there's that. There also may be a series of skills that we in the future might want to focus on. But that's how our general approach to that was.
Yeah, for us, I don't think we target any particular KSAs. I know with the groups that I run back at school that my primary goal is demystification. Right, demystify software, demystify hardware, and give them the sense that nothing's off limits. And just remove the handcuffs, whatever misconceptions they may have, and get them to do the deeper dive willingly, and just sort of open up their eyes to what you can do.
I would say we don't focus on any specific thing. I will say the thing we did that I think is the most educational is we decided in 2012 that after the entire competition was over and we kind of before we announced the winner, but after the game, the server had been shut down and everything, we had each team spend 30 minutes and make five slides about what their offensive strategy was, what their defensive strategy was. And I think we asked them five questions, just rough overview. And I think that's honestly the most educational part. And now it's kind of sad you get maybe 30 minutes out of, or I guess an hour and a half out of the 15 teams presenting five slides in 5 minutes or whatever of this. But it really is, you learn that half the teams out there's firewall rule was just dropping any packet that had more than 4 A's in a row. And if you had all wanted your attacks to work, you could have just switched them to B's, right? That legitimately, 5 teams independently discovered this and tried it and did it. So you get a lot of that. I think it's really just, you built a sandbox. And people can learn as much or as little as they want while there. And your job is to make sure that you have a bunch of interesting problems for them to kind of chip away at.
I think that the what they get the most in certain situations is if the preparation is long enough, is that they really have to think really hard about how they're going to be hit. So I remember being in this strategy session with some of my students say, wow, they could do this, and they could do that. And they're just going crazy, fantasizing about the horrible things that is going to be done to them and how they can deflect them. So can we do an LD preload style where we, put a library so that we'll call our code before the... And this is, I think, and it's related to what he was saying. I mean, of course, a high schooler won't be able to do that because it doesn't know even what are the meteors that can hit them. But when you go to computer science advanced undergrad and grad, they have those. I mean, they understand that, oh, okay, they could try this. So why can we, what kind of filtering can we do on this? And this, I think, is this type of thinking really pre-analyzing the possibilities of attacks and defining defenses for those, I think, is where, and tool development to address those issues are really what they get out of it. And then there is, you know, the high of the 8 hours, 2 days, 3 days of the competition where you go crazy and then everything breaks and all your defense that were so carefully developed go to crap. Huh? And so it's a lot of learning.
It's interesting to me that there's so many no particular skills responses, but then the skills that are listed seem really essential core, like analytic thinking, being able to do research on the internet about a system you haven't learned before. Like, those are exactly things that I think most colleges would want to write as KSAs for their courses. I don't think you should undersell the no particular skill. Maybe it's just because they're not written down yet. I had a question about scoring, to go back to scoring. How important is scoring? It seems like it's a large sore point, like perhaps scoring could ruin your day, or perhaps there are people that like the structure of the game and the amount of support in place that scores become irrelevant because they're having a great time and learning stuff. What are your experiences with
designing? If you're going to an award and a prize, your scoring better be pretty stinking good. So, you know, in that respect, scoring can become very important.
Yeah. Or if there are potential...
I think that it absolutely has to be well-designed, clear. I mean, I think that the few times that we had mini, you know, revolts in CTFs is where our communication on how the scoring system worked was not clear, and it was our fault, obviously. And people were furious. I mean, it's like, you didn't tell me that I would lose this point if I do this, and now I lost the point, and you know, and they get really emotional because they want to win. And so when you're in a competition, the scoring mechanism has to be absolutely transparent, and the rules must be absolutely clear, and it has to be automated. You cannot have people going and say, oh, yeah, you did well. Here's 60 points. People do not react well to that.
So unambiguous, automated, transparent, but otherwise arbitrary? Or
Yeah, could be arbitrary. We tried really weird stuff in the 10th CTF that we ran. Some of the stuff was, you know, there's some randomness to it.
So we have probably our CTF group who develops our CTF at our lab has spent more time talking about scoring than anything else in the entire game. Because, I mean, challenges and stuff, we all sort of knew what those would be like, but every CTF has a different scoring algorithm, and I could honestly talk for probably 5 hours plus on just every idea we had, all of the difference. You know, we had multi-slide scoring algorithms that took like 4 or 5 PowerPoint slides to explain. We had the one I showed during my talk. I almost wrote a paper. My paper for this conference was almost entirely just how to score a CTF, and decided I couldn't cover it in the page limit given. So you have to establish what you want to evaluate on. So we had, you know, we had scoring algorithms that too heavily favored defense. We had scoring algorithms that too heavily favored offense. We came up with entire visualizations of a score to attempt to determine whether a scoring algorithm was too defensive or offensive focused. And I think it really just boils down to, it needs to be simple enough that there are no surprises. So what, no matter how you decide to weight things or how you decide to score your CTF, the ability for anyone to look at it and say, yeah, if I do better, if I do what I should be doing. So like ours, we try to go for some realism, and it says like, if I treat this as if like I'm an actual employee at an actual company / actually an evil person at the same time, if I'm doing what I should be doing, my score should be higher if I'm better at it than everyone else. So if I'm defending, if fewer of my flags are getting stolen, if I'm stealing more flags, my score should be higher than the other people who are stealing, you know, flags, but fewer than me.
There's a million scoring algorithms out there, and everybody will debate the merits of each one. There's a couple important things. One is when you put a scoring algorithm out there, it should be obvious to a player what they need to optimize behavior-wise in the game to win the game. You could come in with a misconception that defense is going to win it, but the scoring algorithm, when you sit back and dissect it, actually tells you that offense is what you needed to be doing. So it's nice that if they're out there ahead of time, so you can sit and contemplate perhaps how that's going to factor into any strategy that you might employ in the game. And the other thing from an organizer is whatever you put out there for a scoring algorithm, you better be able to measure it. So you know, if you say you're going to measure X, you better be measuring X, and you better be measuring it accurately, because that's the thing they're going to come after you on. Whether you did or did not measure effectively, and they only failed because you didn't measure it or your system was broken, et cetera.
And I just wanted to second what Chris said. If there's prizes on the line, and then, of course, in education, your scoring mechanism better be rigorous and right on the money.
So I have a question about scoring that relates to two other topics we've already discussed, which is, one, inclusion, and two, the use of these games in the classroom. So all the CTFs I ever participated in, which isn't a lot, all the scoring has always been all or nothing. So how do we, challenge-based CTFs are particularly this way, right? You get all of 100 points or 0 points. How do we build scoring systems that provide scaffolding, for example? How do you build a partial credit score in a challenge-based or even a true CTF-type game? Or more broadly, how do we build scoring mechanisms that help in an educational and inclusive settings?
I would say the problem is that security is relatively binary. So either, I mean, when someone gets hacked, it's like, well, they got in and stole all of our data, but they didn't go in this other way, so we're good. Or, right, or we hacked in and we got most of the way there, but we didn't get anything important. That's not, you didn't get in. I mean, it's a relatively binary thing, right? If the system's secure or not, well, has it been broken into, then, you know, it's not. It doesn't really matter how much, you know, how up to date your AV was. If you still got, you know, if they still stole your data, who cares?
I disagree with that.
Yeah.
I
disagree as well. From the perspective of an educational, we don't want a scenario where someone spends 2 days and trying to hack at some binary and then doesn't get anything out of it because they couldn't get the last bit. And that's a very frustrating experience. And if we want people to keep learning, we don't want to frustrate them to the point that they stop forever. Well, we don't want to dissuade people from leaving. And so we realized this when we were doing FIGO CTF, that this could be a real issue. And so without changing the format of it too much, without shaking things up too much, what we did is we established a series of problems. So we had overflow 1 to overflow 5. Overflow 1 was the simplest one. And to do overflow 2, you basically need to have the concept in overflow 1 under control. Basically, for the first problem, you had to type like 7 A's and a B. And the next one, you had to start jumping to, instead of the B, you do a function address. And then you build up until, okay, now you got to go into libc. And having these steps, they're all discrete problems, but they build on top of one another. And so to someone that is very experienced, instead of doing one problem that is overflow 5, they just kind of breeze through it really quick. And it seems relatively transparent to them. If anything, it makes them feel great, because they just solve 5 challenges back to back. But for the people that are learning one thing at a time, you kind of isolate skills and you isolate things. And in the problem descriptions, we made it very clear what you needed to do and what you wanted to learn in that one. And so we had a number of these series, one based on buffer overflows, string format attacks, Python jail boxes, things like that.
I would say that there are also things that you can say. For example, you put a piece of code in front of somebody, say, can you crash it in a way that you think, you know, will bring, for example, EIP on 414141, so you know that you control it. Maybe you don't have the ability to do a full ROP attack that bypasses all those protections and have code executed, but you can say you get partial credit for being able to pinpoint a particular input that would crash in a way that you think it's exploitable. Difficult to evaluate, I agree with you. Very difficult to evaluate. But I think there are opportunities where you can do partial credit. I think it's a mistake. It would complicate the game uselessly, so I wouldn't do it. But I think you can do it. I think that the solution for scaffolding is that making more simpler challenges. As I think Chris was saying, you know, CTFs are becoming incredibly complicated. This DEF CON, and you know, I returned to playing DEF CON after hiatus due to toddlers, but this DEF CON was insane. I mean, we were looking at the challenges, and I you know, Chris and I started, you started before me, but I started, I think, in 2003, 2004 playing, so 10 years of DEF CON, and there was another planet. I mean, I remember SQL injections. You know, now people won't even consider things because they're for babies. Now it's insanely complicated. So that's definitely something that you will not see.
So I guess I wasn't even saying, in a realistic scenario, it's binary, yes or no. We may be able to come up with partial credit, but I think the easiest way, if we want to do that, is to have a system where you can have multiple effects. So for our CTF, for example, if you had a 40414, you can send that out to another team and crash their server, and they get availability points knocked off. But I would say they succeeded in that case. They didn't get part of the way there. They did succeed in carrying out a effect. So I guess in a way of kind of building up scaffolding, you can have various effects.
You can measure success or failure, right?
Right, yeah. It's basically, it comes back to a binary case still.
I've lost track of time. Do we have? So I want to. Oh, thank you. I want to point out that the mic's always open and that you only have about 10 minutes left to jump on and ask a question. But I have a follow-up question. So, is there any way to do scaffolding in the context of a sort of peer-to-peer attack defend exercise? Or are those just sort of?
I think we thought about it, and I think that the only scaffolding is the level of bragging rights. Look at DEF CON. There is the DEF CON CTF, and because the DEF CON CTF was so selective, now they have an open CTF where everybody can participate. But of course, winning the open CTF is not as cool as winning the DEF CON CTF. So you can do some scaffolding based on, you know, sort of the reputation of something. But for example, we have a high school student working with us who's simply insanely good. And, you know, he's 16, so I took him to Hacker Jeopardy, and he sat there and annihilated every kid in the room for the whole hour, to the point that he said, okay, I'm not gonna answer questions anymore because it's not fair. You will always find this, you know, or Tom Cruise, you know, who plays alone at qualification at DEF CON CTF, and by himself, he qualifies, if not first, second, something like that. Those are, you know, things that make scaffolding really hard, because you drop one of these guys in a competition and makes everybody walk away. But I think that by, you know, I wouldn't bother playing at a, you know, open CTF. Maybe I should, but right now I wouldn't bother. And so people that maybe are less skilled can participate, or they care, you know, less about their reputation. So I think you can create scaffolding like that.
So you guys are starting to make me feel a little bit like Sesame Street here. So let me express the Sesame Street point of view for educators. I think the difference we're talking about here is the difference between novice learning and expert learning. Because there is a point when you've established mastery, but in this field, you can't rest on your laurels. And so giving them the unexpected, they don't need any scaffolding. The harder we make it for them, the better off we're all going to be. But for novice learning, we need to provide that scaffolded experience. And so what concerns me is that in terms of the problems we need to solve, we were talking about scoring and we're talking about scaffolding, but I think the first problem we need to solve for competitions in education in general is we have to make them less time-consuming to create. Because once it's out there, it's done, right? It's trash. You have to throw it away. But you know, so until we can solve that problem, then we can't solve the other pieces that go along with it.
So people on our panel have sort of released some of their infrastructure open source. Is that a good way towards replayability?
Depending on the quality.
So yeah, we thought it would be just very valuable to the community to have some of the tools that we use to host the competition available as an open source project, and a lot of people have jumped on that. It's been useful in a lot of ways. It's increased the diversity of the competition. So one competition I didn't highlight during my talk was HSCTF. It was by one of the teams that played in Pico CTF. They took our code and they hosted their own CTF nationwide for high school students. And that really, their twist on the competition was they didn't only include computer security problems, they included problems from like Project Euler. So in that sense, it gives people, there are more people creating competitions, so there's more opportunities to play, and they're using some of the resources that we provided for them. Additionally, I think there are opportunities to, this kind of happens with organizations like Smash the Stack, where they create problems and they try to their best to make it so that you can't just copy an answer from the internet. The answer, you need to actually walk through the steps to do it, and it could be that they have their own version of the problem, and this allows them this forces people, even if they can look up a step-by-step guide on how to do this problem, it forces them to actually go through the steps. And so that helps a little bit in that regard.
Do any of you feel that some sort of guide on how to use EC2 to spin up a temporary CTF using whatever tools have been released is a helpful way in bringing other people up to speed on lowering this barrier to entry in making games?
I think that the best thing would be a solution where you can go to a website and you have a series of challenges and you just select the challenges that you want, you press a button, and you get VMs that you can just spin out and create your CTF in a very free way. I think that would be the best possible way to do that. And I'm just laughing because that's exactly what we're going to release today. So. Hopefully it will be used, but it's all still in beta.
I will say, I think one of the problems is the people who write these aren't software engineers. So like we wrote this huge framework and this huge thing, and you know, like half the error message include the cell phone number of the person who wrote it, because that's the only way this is ever going to work is if you call that person and have him explain to you what he was thinking at 4 in the morning when he wrote that. And it's just there's no market. I mean, there is a market for polished, you know, probably canned CTFs that allow you to do such a thing of like select some things and fire one up on EC2. But as far as I know, there's a market for it, but no one's willing to pay for it. So I don't know if I don't.
There's a market for it, and people pay for it.
Well, true. There are.
I know this to be true.
Okay. So maybe people do pay for it, but there's. Definitely none, like, so every year we find one and we build a new CTF, like an Android-based one, and that requires a lot of custom jerry-rigging to get, like, Android emulators on there. I mean, we wrote our own Android emulator, not for this, but we had to write our own Android emulator to do something like this. So, I mean, just to have creative CTFs, you need a lot of bootstrapping. It's just difficult to not have to be written every time.
So increasingly, there is actually a market for internal CTFs where a company will invite people in to run a CTF, and it's geared for either team building internal to the company or perhaps educational and so on. But yeah, definitely in the open, I don't know. We never received any funding to put on our CTFs. Most people don't receive a lot of funding to put on their CTFs. So that getting back to the inclusivity, exclusivity, it's like you're not paying to play. So I'm sorry that you have complaints with the way we're running it, but I'm not getting paid to run it either. So,
and I would say that the thing that we're trying to do is create a framework where people can plug in their own services, so people can send us, you know, a dev package that will be, if it follows certain standards, it can be used as part of a competition. So our dream eventually is to crowdsource the development of vulnerable services, which is the most painful part. Because once you got the infrastructure more or less right, you're fine. But the services every time are the things that are the thing that take the most time. So it's probably going to be trash the moment it's out. You're right. We're not software engineers. We put this together with spit and duct tape. But hey, you know, we get asked all the time, Giovanni, I want to run this, you know, in my class. What do I have to do? And so we put out something, but it got outdated. They didn't even boot anymore. And these are people that ask us, hey, what's the root password on this VM? And you're like, if you ask me this, you shouldn't be around a CTF. And we want to make it, in any case, more inclusive so that I have the infrastructure to run it.
Well, I want to thank our panel for being here. Can we give them a round?